So if you know you're writing to someone more traditional, more formal, from a different generation than you, think about what they, how they will receive the text, not just about sort of expressing yourself the way that's natural to you.
As a business owner, you'll know you either need to hire a writer or become a writer. Welcome to the show where you'll hear conversations covering everything you need to know about writing for and about your business.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. I'm very excited to bring to you today Casey Mank from Bold Type LLC. And Casey has taught in writing classrooms for over 10 years, most recently at Georgetown University School of Nursing and Health Studies. She's taught writing to professionals at Fortune 500s, government agencies, and PR and communication firms. Casey serves on the board of directors at the Nonprofit Center for Plain Language and is proud to have helped thousands of writers get to the point and reach their audiences with greater impact. So, Casey, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here chatting with you.
Okay, so you serve on the board of the Nonprofit Center for Plain Language. What is plain language, first of all, and why is it so important for all of us? And something that I often talk about is that if you are a business owner, you either need to hire a writer or become a writer. And, you know, even if you are hiring out your writing, I think there's a certain amount you should know about writing. So, yeah, what is plain language and why do we need to know about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So plain language is a movement that started to help really complex topics make sense to the public. So it started with mostly government organizations and technical topics, but now it's really spread to a lot of other industries, including healthcare, financial services. And plain language is all about making sure that audiences can really understand the materials you're giving them. So one way to think about this is a lot of experts, subject matter experts, business owners, they feel that if they give accurate information, like if they put out all the information and it's accurate, that that's where their responsibility ends. And that it's the responsibility of the public or the readers or the customers to, you know, dig through there and figure it out, right? Because they've been provided with everything. But plain language takes a different approach, which is it's the responsibility of the authoring individual or the authoring organization to make sure it's impossible for people to misunderstand the information that they provide, which is a really different, way of thinking about communicating information. So if listeners are interested in plain language and getting into the nitty gritty of it a little more, I'd recommend plainlanguage.gov. Mm-hmm. And the Center for Plain Language, where I'm involved, is North America, so Canada, Mexico, US, but there's people doing plain language all over the world. It's not just plain English. Mm-hmm. There's plain Danish and plain French, plain Hebrew. So this is really an international movement, and it helps, you know, technical topics to become more accessible to the public who needs to actually use that information.
Yeah, fantastic. And I mean, coming from academia, for me, I could really see that to be useful in a lot of places. Is it kind of public facing only, or is it kind of internal within organizations that you also work?
Sure. That's a really interesting question. And it comes up a lot when we do plain language training. So technically, there's only a need for things to be plain language compliant if they are public facing, right? So an organization can get sort of a mandate from the top down to say, you all need to work harder to make your public facing materials accessible and plain language. Mm-hmm. But I think all of those same principles can and should be applied to internal things, even informal things like emails. You absolutely can write your colleague a plain language email saying, can you review this before our meeting on Friday? And here's what I need you to answer in a really clear way that doesn't ramble and isn't confusing. So the official application of plain language usually is more like public facing to, you know, the masses and everything like that. But you can absolutely use all of those same principles for any kind of interpersonal communication, internal memos, stuff like that.
Definitely. Yeah, that's so helpful. Okay. So I know you've taught in lots of different contexts with different teams, writing all sorts of different types of texts as part of their work. So it's not necessarily people who see themselves as writers. Are there certain problems that you see coming up again and again with the students or clients that you work with?
Yes, absolutely. So most of the professionals that we work with, I would say it's about half and half. Half might be in a communications heavy role, and they probably do see themselves as writers, communicators, content creators. And then the other half are people that simply have normal roles. They might be in marketing, they might be in sales, they might be a team manager. And they definitely, like you said, would not think of themselves as a writer, but they actually are producing a lot of text. And then in the university, I actually teach scientific research writing, which of course is way different from business communications, but there actually are a few themes even between all those groups. One that I would go for right away is just trying to sound fancy by overcomplicating things. So when professionals do this, they add big words, they make their prose more complex, they use passive voice, they have these really long, convoluted sentences, and it's all in an effort to say, like, I'm professional, I'm an expert, I'm smart, you should trust what I'm saying because I'm, you know, being fancy and I'm being formal. The students, what I see them try to do more often in like a research writing context is they think it seems that a complex idea all has to happen in one sentence.
Yes.
And I don't know where this idea came from, right? That if you have one idea and it's a complex one, which it often is in academic writing, that it all has to somehow like fit into the structure of one single sentence. And that's when you get like a 7-line long sentence in a paragraph. And it never seems to occur to them that you could simply say, you know, the study had 300 participants, period. The first result was, right? You don't have to like squeeze everything about it into one sentence and somehow make that work. So I think it's a similar phenomenon where people think like, I have to show the complexity and sophistication of my thinking in writing. And that's the worst for your end reader in both cases. So
yeah, interesting. Yeah. Even if it's not coming from a place of I need to show that I'm really fancy, it's just perhaps, you know, they've got all this knowledge in their head and they're just trying to get it out and they don't necessarily know that it's coming across like that. I'd be interested to hear your take, actually. Something that I often suggest to writers is if they've got lots of long sentences like that and it's really, really dense, to break it up. And a kind of nice rule of thumb is to have one short sentence, one longer sentence. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I tell people the same thing all the time because, you know, in our workshops, we're giving the advice, let's go look for a long sentence and break it into some short sentences. You know, short sentences are better. But I do always say I'm not advocating for 8-word sentences only in an entire document. That would be weird. It would be unpleasant. What I am advocating for is if you catch 3 long sentences all in a row, you've got to give your reader a break somewhere in there. So yeah, I totally agree with your
team. Okay, good, good. I'm glad we're on the same page, so to speak there. Yeah, because otherwise, if you end up having lots of short sentences, it can sound really staccato, can't it? So yeah, a mix of the two. Would you use some kind of software for that? I mean, I got, you know, I use something like Pro Writing Aid to just highlight sentence length and things like that. Is there anything like that you recommend?
Yeah, we recommend the Hemingway app in all of our workshops. It's a free editing. Well, it's not exactly an editing software. It actually doesn't proofread at all. It only flags stylistic things, which is kind of interesting. But one of the main things that we think it's useful for is it will show you which sentences are very long and complex and difficult to read. And it's just nice because it's sort of color codes things. Yeah. So it can give you like a quick visual direction of where to focus your editing attention. I think sometimes it's intimidating for people that have a lot of work to produce and they're in a hurry to think, oh my gosh, I have to go through every sentence in this document and make it amazing. No, you don't. Just make some of the worst ones better. And I would be happy, honestly.
Brilliant. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, something like that can help you just see things that you can't necessarily see for yourself and do it more quickly, which is always good. Yeah. Okay. I was having a little browse of your blog before we got on the call, and I saw you talking about exclamation marks. So I just wanted to ask you your opinion of exclamation marks.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is such a fun and interesting question. It's a really good case study for tone, which is something we talk a lot about in our workshops. I think people talk about the tone of writing a lot and writers have a lot of questions about it, but it's also pretty slippery to like nail that down. Like, where is tone actually happening? And exclamation marks are one of the really obvious ways where we can sort of find that happening in business communications. So I wrote a blog post about this with actually my mentor. So we're from kind of different generations of writers. And we just both discussed our take on the exclamation point. And I think the takeaway is you know, different people read them really differently. Sometimes more senior employees will tend to read them as like, this person is shouting, whereas millennials, newer employees tend to read it as, this is friendly, this is showing energy and enthusiasm. And if someone doesn't use exclamation points, they're mad at me. They're giving me this like terse, cold tone, right? So the point isn't that we're all going to decide what they mean as a society and then get on the same page. That's not plausible. We can't do that. But I think what's actually better is for writers to just think about the person they are communicating with at that moment. And everything we teach comes back to audience awareness and thinking about the end reader and what they're going to, how they're going to perceive this. So if you know you're writing to someone more traditional, more formal, from a different generation than you, think about what they, how they will receive the text, not just about sort of expressing yourself the way that's natural to you. And I think also bringing in a neutral, you know, third party, a colleague, a friend, your sister, your mom, whoever, just to say, hey, glance over this and tell me like, what tone are you taking away from this email?
Okay.
That takes 30 seconds, yeah. You can't always do that on your own. So.
Yeah. I know for a fact that I'm a massive overuser of exclamation marks. I don't know if that tells you something about my generation, but whenever I write an email, without a doubt, I go through and remove about 3 or 4 exclamation marks. I can't have an exclamation mark in every sentence. So yeah, that's interesting. Okay. Another thing I wanted to talk to you about was hedging. So things like, you know, and I'm British, obviously, so we do a lot of hedging. You know, would it be a problem for you to have a look over this? Something like that. Why may you, hedging intended, or may not you want to use hedging in your writing? So let's say, for example, you're going to write an email back to quote someone for some work. Is there an effect that too much hedging might have? What would be too much hedging?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to recommend against most of it. I think if you leave one or two of those types of words in a communication, just to give a tiny bit of like flavor or personality, that's okay. But I think everyone really needs to be working to cut those words out for the most part. So in the example you gave, you know, if someone's like sending a quote to a client, if you write to them and you say, I'm thinking around $5,000 for the engagement you suggested, but I'd love to get a read on what you maybe think about that. It just sounds like you're opening up the door for negotiation, yes, even if you're not. Yes. And I think the reason writers do it is to sound polite and accommodating. But what that really says is like, you're open to negotiation on that price. You haven't done this many times before. You're not confident that that's the right price. It opens up a whole host of sort of doubts, questions, and ways for the client to, you know, negotiate or even question whether you just feel confident in what you're quoting them, which is really bad. You know, so if you're just telling them like, this is the price, there's nothing rude about that.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. Yeah. For the engagement that you suggested. That's not rude. It's not mean. You don't need to say like, oh, I'm thinking somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000. That's just, it's bad for them. It's bad for you. It's bad for the entire interaction, really.
Yeah, it is what it is. And it's just saying, right, this is what it is. And if it works, then it's going to be good. And if it doesn't, then yeah.
There's a lot of really positive ways that you can channel that impulse to be sort of polite and deferential. So instead you might say, it's $5,000 for the engagement you suggested. I am so excited to plan with you and hear your thoughts and, you know, like tailor this for your team. You can be effusive in other areas that aren't negative, saying like, I just had a little question, or I just had a little idea, or maybe we could try this. You can always channel that impulse in sort of more positive ways rather than like minimizing, you know, your own knowledge or level of assurance.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think something, when I first started working, I worked in Austria. So my first job was actually at the University of Economics and Business in Vienna. And I really noticed there in the communications with colleagues, there was no hedging. Like that, totally different to a British environment. That was just, this is what it is, this is what we do. And my husband as well, from working in Vienna and then coming back to a British environment, which is slightly different, where we do tend to use a bit more hedging. But I must say that I have, as I've been working for longer and as I've been in business longer, then I've started to use less hedging. And I think you're right. It is a matter of confidence as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Although yeah. I do have a confession to make. When I sent Casey an email to ask her to come on the show, because I heard her speaking on another podcast and I thought, oh, this is great. I'd love to dive into this topic of plain language. I spent so long writing that email because I was like, oh, I better not make any mistakes. I better make sure it's really plain.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I started my company with another writing expert, my business partner. Her name is Grace Aldridge Foster, and she and I often swap important emails. To this day, we do it frequently, like every week, and she'll take a couple hedges out of my emails and I'll take a couple hedges out of her emails. And the reason we're able to do that for each other is because it's not emotional to us. When I look at an email she's sending to someone that's important, I don't feel nervous because it has nothing to do with me. And I'm like, oh, there's, you know, a little bit, there's a maybe, there's a just, I just pull them out, I delete them and I send it back to her. And she can do the same thing for me.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? I'm going to go back and have a look at the email I sent you after this now and see how many hedges I had in there, because that was probably not something I was looking at or conscious of. So that'll be a really interesting little study there. Okay. And I would encourage listeners as well to go and have a look at some of the emails you sent and see how much hedging there is in there.
Yeah. See if you can even just remove one. That's a great way to start. Just one from an email.
Yeah. Okay. You've got a really nice blog post where you talk about purchasing your reader's attention. Could you just explain to listeners what you mean by that and how we can do it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we tend to assume that when people come to any piece of content we've created, any, and I'm talking about anything, it can be as short as a tweet or as long as an 80-page memo. When they come to the content, that they are committing in some way to starting with the first word and reading all the way to the last word. But that's not how actual real readers behave at all. There's a pre-reading step where people sort of look at what you've sent. They're not really reading the words yet, and they just sort of look at it and they think, is this going to be a waste of my time? Or do I actually want to invest the mental energy and attention to read this document? And this isn't happening at a conscious level. Like we're not all thinking these thoughts, you know, every time we look at something. It's just happening a lightning multi like second decision. You look at something and you're like, do I want to read this or not? And in those seconds, people are looking at anything that visually stands out. So the first couple lines of the document, a title, a bolded heading, a call out box. And if you can't tell them something in those places that makes them think, I'll find answers to my questions, I'll find value in this document, I want to read this document, it's going to be well organized, it's going to be easy to understand, then they're likely to just sort of put it aside. So if you think about your own digital reading behaviors, think how easy it is when you're in your inbox to see, you know, a marketing email that has, you definitely are not going to buy, you don't want to read it. It's, there's nothing easier than just deleting that. Like you make that decision before you even consciously think about it. You're like, oh, another marketing email. Yeah. We just got out of here. So unless they can tell you something in that subject line, in the case of email, that makes you want to invest more attention in that thing, you're just going to, you know, pass it by. So that's what that means, is like in that first initial sweep when they're just looking, is there something you can do to purchase more of their attention? And then they might actually read your sentences. So no one is just starting off with that step, unless they're reading a novel or something, but that's not really what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, quite. And readers probably aren't going to read everything of what you've written, are they?
You know, absolutely not.
No. And that can be quite disheartening. You know, you spent hours agonizing over your writing, perhaps, or over an email or over a blog post. But readers aren't going to read it all, are they? So that's, I think that's a really important point to get home. So perhaps thinking about breaking it down, would you suggest that? Or using, like you said, using headings and bullets. Is that all part of it? Yeah.
Yeah, anything you can do to break up the density of the text. So like you just mentioned, bullets, breaking things into smaller paragraphs or chunks of content, headings, all of those are things that let people kind of dip in and out and just take like a little bite-sized piece of information, which is actually good because then they might take an interest in reading more deeply. But if you just hit them with a big paragraph, there's a strong chance they're going to think, I don't have time for that today.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, something that my listeners, a lot of my listeners have in common is that they're experts in their field, you know, they're subject specialists, they've been working in their field for a long time, but they're writing for non-experts. You know, it's this idea of the curse of knowledge, isn't it? It's all in our head, we know so much about it, and we don't realise the gap that's there, that where other people are. So are there any tips you can give, particularly about writing for a non-expert reader?
Absolutely. So first, I'm just going to repeat what I said earlier about everybody visiting plainlanguage.gov, because that is 1,001 ways with examples of how to break down complex topics for general readers. So definitely check that out. One thing I would say at the sort of word or sentence level is, can you provide translations of difficult concepts into simple words, or can you give concrete examples? So two ways that that can go. If you have some language that you might be aware is sort of specialized that not everyone understands, and a great way to be sure about that, if you're just too far into it and have, as you said, the curse of knowledge, which is a concept that we love. If you have too much knowledge about your topic and you can't even tell what other people would know, bring in someone who does know, which can be anyone. The great thing is they don't have to be an expert. Call your cousin, call your mom.
Better if they're not an expert in that case.
It's better. Better. So just, you know, grab someone in your life and say, like, would you know what this means, this phrase or this sentence? And if they say no, then you're going to want to use one of these kind of magic word phrases, which is, in other words, what that means is, what this means is, this means, what that means for you, you being the reader, right? And then whatever comes after that to sort of translate that concept. Or if you don't want to do that, another great tactic to take for non-experts is to give concrete examples. So if you have a really difficult concept, I'm thinking of one from a recent workshop I did. Someone was writing about biosecurity.
Okay.
I'll be honest, I don't even really know what that means. But they're writing about biosecurity, right? So what you would do is take that vague concept and give some really concrete examples. Like, that means when we take a sample for medical purposes, we don't let anyone else use it for anything you haven't signed off on. Or that means, you know, the blood we draw stays in the lab, right? Like, really concrete, really clear, breaking those things down. So those are two ways to handle that for non-experts.
Oh, that's very useful. And I think as kind of outsiders, quite often, I know both of us work with really specialist writers, don't we, who we're not necessarily, we don't necessarily know anything about their field. We both teach in, you know, medical or nursing departments. In a way, that's really good because that gives us that outside perspective. Does what you're writing make sense to me as a general reader? So yeah, it can be really useful to ask somebody else to have a look. Before I let you go, something I ask all my guests is, what book are you currently reading, or what book would you recommend to listeners?
So I have on my shelf, and I haven't started it yet, but I think it's going to be really relevant to everything we discussed, Erica Dewan's Digital Body Language. So when we were talking about the exclamations and all of that, that's Erica Dewan, Digital Body Language. It's literally sitting on my shelf. I can see it from where I'm sitting, staring at me, and I can't wait to read it because it's so relevant to everything that we talked about today. And then one that I would recommend, that we always recommend to people, is Ginny Reddish's Letting Go of the Words. It's a plain language book about web writing, and it will really teach you all the science and the research behind that question of sort of purchasing people's attention and meeting their needs rather than just like expressing the stuff you wanted to express, really thinking about the audience that's going to use the text you produce.
Great. Oh, thank you so much. I will definitely link to both of those and be going off to buy them straight after this because they're not books I've read before. So Casey, where can listeners connect with you? Where can they find out more about working with you? And perhaps you better say something about your company and, you know, how you work with companies and the kind of workshops you do as well.
Sure, absolutely. So my company, Bold Type, does mostly team trainings. We do really interactive virtual workshops for groups of 15 people or fewer. And we also do executive coaching. So if there's one person on someone's team that they know needs a little bit of support developing their writing skills, that's another thing we can do as well. We do talks and lectures for big groups on all sorts of writing topics. Our signature workshops are writing in plain language, which of course we've been talking about plain language a lot today, email writing masterclass, and then a writing and editing workshop that goes over kind of all our best practices for writing and editing. So those are team trainings. And where people can find us, add me on LinkedIn, follow the company on LinkedIn, our website, www.boldtype.us. We try to keep updated there with any sort of public ticketed workshops we have. They're all virtual. So if people want to come to a webinar or workshop that we have coming up, that's where they can find us. And you can always email me. One thing I'll say is I love to get bad writing examples from the internet. So the thing is, it has to be public facing. Right. Can't be something private. Yes. But if you're just, if you're just living your life and you see something like horribly written on the internet, you can email me, casey@boldtype.us.
Oh, love
it. I can use those as before and afters in my workshops, and I love to get them. So
brilliant. Okay. So I would encourage you all to do that. And yeah, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you so much, Lizzie. This was such a fun conversation.
If you need more help with your writing, head on over to my website, lizzietangye.com, where you can find a ton of resources to help you. There's a free author workbook to help you decide which book to write and focus your ideas, along with daily email guidance from me for a week as you work through the questions in the workbook. You'll also find links to everything mentioned on this show in the show notes.